Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And we start today with some breaking news. 40 Black and Latinx leaders from across the Commonwealth are coming together to address disparities and inequities in our healthcare system. The Health Equity Compact includes leaders from hospitals, businesses, public health, academic institutions, and more. And they'll be presenting the agreement at a press conference at the Dimmock Community Health Center in Roxbury this afternoon. But first, two of the organizers are joining us here on Radio Boston with an exclusive peek. Here with us in studio to Michael Curry, CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the NAACP's Board of Directors, and Juan Lopera, the Chief Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer at Beth Israel Lahey Health. Michael, welcome back.
Glad to be back.
And Juan, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
So there's a lot I want to dive into here in this partnership in terms of public momentum, awareness, why now? But let's start with your why. What was the moment for each of you? And Michael, I'll start with you. The moment where you were like, something has to change, change now. We have to do something differently and we can.
Well, you know, it's so funny. I think it's a culmination of moments, right? I think about people who've been fighting uphill to deal with health inequities for a long time. I think about John Auerbach, Boston Public Health Commission, for many years. I think about Dr. Joe Betancourt, who you've had as a guest, who's been fighting this fight around health inequities for years. And then COVID hit. And all of a sudden, what they had been telling us for years, which is that there are people who are more likely to have disease and that there's a cause for it. As Rebecca Lee Crumpler, the first African-American physician, 19th century, said, they seem to forget there's a cause for every ailment and it may be in their power to remove it. So environments, food insecurity, housing insecurity, education, environmentally unsafe communities, racism, all those things we now know as the social determinants of health came to play in COVID, which meant more Black and brown people were essential workers. We were dealing with comorbidities. We were more likely to be hospitalized and die from COVID. So what do we do with all that, right? Now that we've had an epiphany on all these things, how do we now turn that into a movement to deal with those underlying issues that had Black and brown folks dying early? And as we've said, Juan and I've talked about, we've been weathered to death and sickness in Black and brown communities. We have to unweather ourselves.
So Juan, in asking you for your moment, I'm going to tweak my question a little. I was fascinated by Michael just saying, you know, for every ailment, there's a cause and there may be the power to remove it. So what was the moment when maybe you realized that there was power to do something about this in Greater Boston today?
The moment really for me was recognizing that we do have individuals in positions of power and influence in our healthcare system here in Massachusetts. We have individuals like Michael Curry, we have Dr. Maisha Minter-Jordan, Mike, and we have my counterpart at the Med General Brigham, Dr. L.T. Taveras. A number of us came together and said, we have to seize this moment. We are in positions of influence. We have the support of the corner office. Many of us are in C-suite level roles, and we have that lived experience. You know, too many of us have had family members who have passed. I've had to mourn the death of father-in-law, two uncles, in the span of 3 weeks a year ago.
I'm sorry.
And so it's real to us. And it would be irresponsible of us to let this moment go by without looking to make systemic change.
So, Michael, I do want to pick up on this idea of the incredible presence of leaders in power who are Black and Latinx with the announcement. The press announcement was a piece of paper that had the names, the titles, and the pictures of the 40 leaders in this coalition. And having been in Boston, right, for a quarter of a century, yeah, us having had conversations year over year over year about white leadership in Boston ineffectively tackling Black and brown problems, it does look like we are seeing a sea change in where the power lies.
Yeah, so, you know, I've been doing policy work 25 years, right? 16 years at Blue Cross now, 14 years, 10 years at Blue Cross now, 14 years at the Mass League Community Health Centers, and now I'm the CEO. I can tell you, having engaged elected officials on every level, and good-hearted folks who really want to do good and do right, by communities and the communities particularly that they represent. The reality is, if you want to do something around women's health, right, if there's a in terms of maternity care or women's issues, have women in leadership, because it won't just be a conversation. They'll be vested in the solutions. What we've not seen in government is we've not seen people in the for-profit sector. We've not seen a large contingent of black and brown people with lived experiences, Juan said, who actually will make this a top priority, not a priority, not something that gets pushed aside when they're competing interests or competing priorities. What you're now seeing is we have black and Latinx leaders running stuff, hospital systems, health plans, philanthropy with Lee Pelton at the Boston Foundation, who are now coming to say together to say, hey, if we don't do it, who will? If not us, then who? And it presents an opportunity. We've never seen this moment in Massachusetts, never seen this much representation in the government sector and in the private nonprofit sector. We have to seize that opportunity. And if we don't, then again, we've been weathered to higher rates of disease and death in communities of color that meant that black and brown folks will die in their 30s and 40s. Diabetes, heart disease, cancer, 2-3 times more likely to suffer and to die. We can do something about it. I think this is our responsibility to do that, to do it together with our allies in government and in the for-profit, nonprofit sector. This will be a movement that we hopefully are generating today with the announcement.
And I do want to underscore that data. So a study done by the VCU Center on Human Needs in 2012 found that life expectancy of someone living in the Back Bay was almost 90. But right down the road in Roxbury, the number went down to 60. That is a 30-year disparity by neighborhood. And we know that there are massive demographic differences in those neighborhoods around race, income, education level, et cetera.
So, if I could on that, just because why not? So we need to understand what that means, right? Because I don't know if that resonates with everybody. So a 30-year loss in lifespan, right? That's talent being lost. That's workforce being lost. There may be a person that's in that talent pool that's meant to produce something for society that we need to produce. So we need to connect. If you're in Newton right now or Wellesley or Western Mass, I need you to connect with that data point and say, no, this matters to me too, because we're losing a population and we have a responsibility collectively to do something about it.
Collective life, talent, wisdom, capability, learning, community spirit, human capability.
Amen.
So we are talking about the newly announcing later today the Health Equity Compact with Michael Curry, who's the CEO of the Massachusetts Legal Community Health Centers, and Juan Lopera, who's Chief Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer for Beth Israel Lahey Health. So let's get to brass tacks, Juan. Now's the moment. There's a moment of will. There's a moment of power. There's a moment of positions of power. What are you actually going to do?
So we've been meeting now going on about 8 or 9 months virtually. This actually will be the first time today when we actually bring this big family together, because that's what it feels like, is a family of people with lived experience who've been working together for a long time, first time coming together. So over the past 8 months or so, we've been meeting regularly via Zoom, working on a plan, working on a blueprint for how to address health equity the same way that other aspects of health reform have been addressed in Massachusetts. If you think back to universal coverage after 28, the so-called Romney Care, right? When we expanded coverage, and that led the way for the rest of the country to expand coverage. We then had additional chapters of reform in Massachusetts around payment reform and healthcare affordability, chapters 305 and chapter 224. We feel that now is the time to have health equity be that next chapter in health reform in Massachusetts. And within that, we have a number of components, including governance within healthcare policy making. There's a health policy commission in Massachusetts that makes really important decisions regularly, but there isn't a single person of color that's part of that health policy commission. So we need more people in positions in government. We mentioned how we have plenty of, we have growing, we need more representation in the private sector. We need equal representation in the public sector. We also need to be able to measure health equity the way we measure other aspects of healthcare. We were able to measure cost of care. There's pretty well accepted ways of measuring that now, quality of care.
So I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt you there, because I think if I can dig into that cost of care one, we can help people connect with this and maybe even help me connect with this in a different way. What are we doing wrong in the way we measure cost of care that if we did it differently, it would affect health equity outcomes?
What we haven't been able to do is quantify the cost of inequality, right? So if your diabetes is not managed well, that leads to potentially avoidable emergency department visits, hospitalizations. So being able to quantify that is a key component that will come out of this compact work.
In so fact, literally the public health cost, the money yes. cost, as well as the cost to an individual in terms of their time, financial outlay, life expectancy, et cetera.
To employers as well. That's right.
And that's how we got health reform in Massachusetts, right? As Andrew Dreyfus, our good friend at Blue Cross Blue Shield, said to us when we were meeting on this, we got health reform in Massachusetts, became the model for the Affordable Care Act on a national level because we made the business case, right? So not everyone's going to be drawn into the fact there are people dying early and dying of disease. Some people will be drawn in by the dollar impact, that emergency room use is costly, inpatient days are costly. How do we bring down that cost? That's by investing in interventions and in addressing inequities in the system. That's going to resonate with some of the folks we need to move the needle, and particularly policymakers. And I think that's the work. Again, credit to Blue Cross Blue Shield Foundation for the work that they're planning to do with us to actually produce a report around the cost of inequity.
So timing on that, when do we expect to see that report?
We're roughly looking at early next year, so it seems like far away, but we want to make a very comprehensive assessment of all the aspects of the cost of inequality. So roughly early next year is our current time frame.
So, you know, we've talked about the size and scope of unequal access to healthcare, unequal access to the quality of life inputs like stable housing and healthy foods that are sometimes called the social determinants of health, but that we know drive outcomes. I'm thinking to a time when I was working on in a program to break the generational cycle of poverty. And I went to a business plan competition and I made my pitch for our organization. And they shut me down and wouldn't even let me finish the pitch because they found it so implausible that one could break something like the cycle of poverty, that they're like, we need practical stuff you can actually do. Literally wouldn't even let me finish the pitch. So for those who are listening to this conversation and saying, folks, this is hundreds of years old problem. This is deeply rooted in systemic racism. What are 40 people actually going to do that's going to make a difference? What's the answer?
Well, so if I laughed as you were saying that, because of course we get that when people say, well, it's boiling the ocean. Right? What are you trying to boil the ocean? I think the reality is, I've been in policy a long time. We've boiled many oceans in this country. The New Deal was boiling the ocean, right? Dealing with the war on poverty was boiling the ocean. It was dramatic. It was big. New systems and investments. We've done it in Massachusetts with health reform. Many people would have argued prior to the passage of health reform in 2006, that was boiling the ocean. It was too many things, bringing down the uninsured rate, making sure that we have more people with coverage to keep them out of the emergency rooms, dealing with value-based care. How do we invest in care? All of that's boiling the ocean. What we're now asking as 40-plus leaders of color is that the next train leaving the station be one about health equity, that we also dream high around what we can do to eliminate health disparities. It is not that it couldn't have been addressed. It's that it's never been prioritized. I would tease this up for you, Tiziana, as Juan and I talk about. There's a tsunami coming that we've not talked about that I think brings some urgency to this work. Deferred care. So for the last 2 years, Black and brown folks who are already disparately sick and dying were also not able to get care. So where you might have been diagnosed for stage one cancer or stage two cancer, it's now stage four. Now your diabetes is out of control. Now your mental health issue may be exacerbated, or your substance use disorder as we think about mass and cast. And the reality is, in our health center data between 2019 and 2020, screenings for cervical cancer declined by 15%. For colorectal cancer, by 17%. For depression and follow-up care, 19%. The number of patients with controlled blood pressure decreased by 16%. So not only was there a problem before that had folks who look like me, who from my communities, my family members, Juan's family members, dying and suffering, we're now going to see that exacerbated over the next 5 years. And the data won't come out right away. We have to seize this opportunity now.
And on that front, I think that this is exactly the reason why we need this compact, because it could, you know, we're moving out of the pandemic, right? We're getting to a new normal. And for average individual, maybe that's the case, but not for our communities of color. We are having to deal with all that Michael said in terms of deferred care. So we need folks with lived experience who are in these positions of influence to be pounding the table and say, we cannot let this happen again, and we must address these issues now, and they need to be at the front and center of every conversation. Everything should go through an equity lens. Every assessment of health should be stratifying data based on race, ethnicity, so we can have that same data that was staring at us during COVID in terms of age-adjusted death rates, hospitalizations, COVID cases. Same approach should be applied to other aspects of healthcare.
And, right. And I want to give a shout out to Gerald Chatavian from Europe. I was talking to him about today and being on with you. And Gerald said, the problem is we should look at it the same way we look at a fire. He said, when there's a fire, we go to where the fire is, right? We deploy our resources to respond to that fire. And what we've not done around health inequity, we've not deployed our resources to where the fire is, where there are higher rates of disease and death. That's what we're asking for. And I think now that we have more people in the policymaking, leadership, CEO, C-suite level, there's an opportunity. It'll come with some diverging interests and opinions. But that's what health reform in 2006 was. There was hospitals competing, disagreeing with health plans. We got there. We hope that we can get there together.
All right. And last question, Juan, I think I'll turn to you. The first thing you're looking for to know it's working, short term, something. I mean, and listen, I don't mean to overemphasize short term because these are long term problems, but something short term we can look for to know it's working.
Well, I think the resources that are deployed towards paying for equity, right? The way we pay for other aspects of healthcare, we should be reimbursing for organizations that are moving the dial on addressing health disparities. And we're starting to see pieces of that. So I think that's an immediate, you know, it fits within value-based care. We're already moving in that direction. In healthcare, you hear the term often, accountable care organizations embedding health equity into that equation so that we start to reimburse and pay for equity improvement.
So we will follow the money. Mm-hmm. Juan Lopera is the Chief Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer at Beth Israel Lahey Health. Michael Curry is CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. They are two of the founders of the Health Equity Compact being announced this afternoon. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Stay tuned. We are about to switch over. People may not think of Massachusetts as a hot climate, but as we all experienced this weekend, it can get hot here, very hot. But as with so many other things, not all heat is equal. In Chelsea, the entire city is a heat island. That is an urban area that is significantly warmer than the surrounding region, the whole city. In this week's From the Newsroom, WBUR health reporter Martha Biebinger joins us to tell us about what she's learned reporting on the ways that Chelsea has tried to address its heat problem. And that includes a recent effort to cool the city down a block at a time. Martha, welcome back.
Hi, Tiziana.
So recently, you're down in Chelsea, you're reporting on this effort called the Cool Block Project. What is it and who's involved?
Yeah, so it is just starting with one block, and it's an attempt to throw pretty much every urban heat intervention at this one block to see if the city can lower the temperature. So that means planting trees on this nearly treeless area, installing a white roof on a boys and girls club that covers about a third of the block. It means layering a coat of light gray rather than black asphalt on the streets, turning sidewalks into more porous plant-lined surfaces, turning a vacant lot into a park. This is all the brainchild of Green Roots. That's Chelsea's environmentally based group. And the city's on board, along with some researchers at Boston University who are going to kind of monitor the temperatures and feed data into this assessment.
And I'm just going to flag that Boston University owns WBUR's broadcast license here. So how do you pick a block to try out these methods? And how hot are we talking? So you've got a block that you're picking because it's a part of this heat island. What does it mean to be a heat island? How hot are we talking?
The heat island definition means that it's 20 to 40 degrees warmer in the summer than in leafier suburbs. So you might picture the difference between Chelsea and say, Newton, for example, if you've ever driven the streets of either one. This particular block has no shade at all, walking up and down the sidewalks. As I mentioned, there's that Boys and Girls Club at one end and the vacant lot at the other. In between, there are 10 multifamily buildings with paved backyards for parking. It's right near the waterfront in Chelsea, which is very industrial. And so researchers last summer placed sensors all over Chelsea in trees and on buildings. These are researchers from BU. And they found a 7-degree difference from the relatively cooler parts of the city to these hotspots like this block where they're going to try all these interventions.
So
the idea is, the idea is to try to reduce the ambient temperature, you know, down to something more like what's normal in Chelsea.
And so what you're saying is literally the physical characteristics of where you live could make it hotter to live there than somewhere else, despite climate, despite anything else, just because of your physical surroundings.
Yeah. I mean, you walk down a street with no trees along a black asphalt pavement and you just bake. You can feel the heat radiating off of you. And of course, that gets absorbed in many of the older buildings in Chelsea, which are brick, so they turn into these almost like little ovens.
Little brick ovens.
In the summer. Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, that leads to all kinds of greater health risks for people. Heat exacerbates the chances of cardiovascular heart disease, or it makes your asthma worse. It can increase your mental health problems. There are studies that show people are more aggressive in hotter climates. And if you ask the police and fire chiefs in Chelsea, they'll tell you they've noticed those things in these pockets. So it's a real health impact on a daily basis.
So tell us about this choice to do a bunch of things in one block versus a few things in lots of different places, given that Chelsea is entirely a heat island.
Yeah. So the idea here is to see if you layer a lot of these interventions in one place, can you have a greater impact than, say, you know, planting trees across several neighborhoods in the one city. And the reason to do it in such a compact way is to try to see what overlapping strategies work and which don't. And it's also to try to understand how much impact you can have on these especially sweltering blocks. Because Chelsea has very limited resources, so they have to figure out where to spend that money wisely, you know, where to get the best return on their investment. And that's what they hope this block will help them figure out.
So why Chelsea? What are the ingredients there? I mean, I imagine we have other neighborhoods, communities that are heat islands. You've been covering rising temperatures in Chelsea for several years now. What about the response in the city is different? And why is the city able to take on an initiative like this?
Well, there are a lot of things that are unique about Chelsea for all of those questions that you just asked, Tiziana. The demographics of the city make it one of the most vulnerable in our state. So this is many low-income residents who have to walk to work or ride bikes or take buses. They're not driving air-conditioned cars to air-conditioned offices. You know, there are many people are working outside or in unair-conditioned spaces, factories or wherever else. The city uniquely, though, also has an environmental group called Green Roots. There, the project is the brainchild of Green Roots. And so that group means that local residents are driving a lot of the interventions that the city is going to try. And that's going to help the city, that's going to help with buy-in for the project. It's going to help people feel like they own what's happening. And it's going to mean that what happens meets the needs that they've addressed, that they've said, here's what's wrong, here's what we need help with. So those two pieces are really what makes Chelsea somewhat unique when you look around Massachusetts and around the country.
So Martha, in our last minute or so, I mean, our listeners have gotten to know you over the years. And before the pandemic, you were beginning to turn some attention to climate health. Then you went deep for the station in COVID, right, these last 2 years. But is this the beginning of you moving more towards the public health intersection with climate change?
Yeah, that's definitely the plan, Tiziana. And it's not just public health. It's the intersection of health and all of the effects of climate change. You know, so for example, on our health systems, like our hospitals, on our individual health problems, like allergies. I mean, you may have noticed that the headaches and sneezing started earlier this year, and they're going to last longer into the fall. And then it's the broader public health issues like air pollution or heat and cooling one city block.
All right, that is Martha Biebinger, healthcare reporter for WBUR from the newsroom this week. Martha, thanks for the reporting and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tiziana.
Today, we meet artist Wen Ti-Tsin. He has been making art in Boston for decades, and at 86 is just now embarking on perhaps the most ambitious project yet, 4 statues honoring the working people of Boston's Chinatown. This April, Boston Mayor Michelle Wu pledged $1 million to support the project, money it could have taken years to raise. The investment is part of an effort to mark and preserve Chinese culture and contributions in Chinatown, a neighborhood facing the same forces of gentrification as so many others in our greater Boston community. Joining us now, Wen Ti Tsien and Lydia Low. Lydia is the executive director of the Chinatown Community Land Trust, a nonprofit that's working to keep Chinatown affordable for low-income residents. Wen Ti, welcome.
Thank you very much, too. Very happy to be here.
Great to have you. And Lydia, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
So, Wen Ti, we will start with you. When did you first conceive of this project and why?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear this one.
When did you first come up with this idea for this project and why did you want to do it?
Yes, I think actually it could have happened when I was, I'm 86 now, so when I was like 11 or 12, I was in Shanghai in China, and I read a poem from a Chinese poet who came to Chicago in the 1920s and wrote a song of the laundryman. And I was growing up in China, in Shanghai, and the song just struck me of how different a Chinese American's life is in America, and it really moved me that they're channeled into these very limited occupations, and that's a beautiful poem, and it stuck in my head forever. But later on, though, as I work with the community, I became better understanding, came to America and understanding how the people lived and all that. So it's always struck me how hard people have to work in America as a Chinese immigrant.
And so tell our listeners the depictions, these 4 statues, what 4 roles they represent. And as I understand it, it's because you felt that Chinese Americans were limited to a few set of roles in pursuit of economic prosperity.
Yes, it's a long-term, you know, prejudice against the Chinese, you know, since when they were building the railroads. So after the railroads were built, they were limited to very few for a long time, just as a laundryman and in the restaurants. All the other occupations were essentially outlawed to them. And later on,
from the Chinese Exclusion Act.
And later on when, yeah, Exclusion Act and all that. And later on when the Exclusion Act was over and the more Chinese women started to come to America, they became garment workers in the industry here. But later on, that industry was outsourced to the South and then to Asia itself. And the most little bit different concept is I'm having a statue of the grandmother taking care of the children. People often don't think of the caretaker as a work, but actually for this grandmother and also for the child, the influence of each other was very important, and it became a very, I think, significant part of a Chinese American life.
So, Lydia, as a steward of Chinatown, of Chinese American history, of that community in particular, how do you connect with these 4 statues, the idea of these 4 statues and their presence in Chinatown?
I'm just thrilled that this project is really coming into being now. One of the things that the Chinatown Community Land Trust is trying to do is really to lift up the visibility of Chinatown as an important historic and cultural center, not only for our community, but for the region. And I think that the statue project does just that. It synchronizes very well with another project that we have called the Immigrant History Trail, in which we're marking significant points throughout Chinatown as well. It's more of a multimedia project to share Chinatown stories. Chinatown is a historic community. It is an important anchor. It's been an anchor for immigrant working class families for generations, even before the Chinese. It was the Irish, it was the Syrians and the Lebanese. But Chinatown has always been that anchor for immigrant working class families, and we are struggling today to keep it that way.
So we've got these four concepts of the Chinese worker that are coming forward in these statues. You've got, the garment worker, the laundry worker, the restaurant worker, the grandmother. And when we think about those, of course, we think about incredibly hard work for incredibly low pay. Or in the grandmother's case, intergenerational families living together. That comes up against this wave of gentrification that we are experiencing throughout Greater Boston. How do we think about and how are you working towards preserving the next generation of working class housing and affordability in Chinatown? And how important is it that Chinese Americans be part of that?
Well, very important. And of course, some of the work that we do as a community land trust is not only about the cultural piece, but also permanent affordability. So through 99-year ground leases, we keep permanently affordable housing, and we're seeking to keep permanently affordable commercial spaces as well, especially since small businesses have suffered so much in this last period. But I think where it connects with the culture is that you can't have Chinatown remain as an important cultural center if you don't have its working class residents remain. That's sort of our message. And that's what makes it unique as a cultural and historic district. So I think what's so wonderful about One T's project is that it's really lifting up the significance of these immigrant workers who people don't think about most of the time. But these are the people who built the city. These are the people who built our nation. Hardworking people that nobody has really lifted up in the past. So, you know, One T always says, instead of just seeing European generals on horseback, we want to see other depictions as well that really reflect our contribution to American life.
One T, go ahead. I saw you nodding there.
Yes, Lydia say exactly what we were thinking about. At the same time, I see it also, we're celebrating no longer the generals and the politicians, but also I see this as actually celebrating beyond Chinese working people, but to other working people at the same time. Could be European, could be South American or Central American workers. And workers don't get acknowledged very often in the public art, and I think that would be a very important attribute. Just because they're Chinese doesn't mean that they're limited to being Chinese.
So there's a sense of solidarity for you in depicting working class Chinese Americans with these statues to an honoring and understanding of the role of people who do blue collar work, who do manual labor in our communities more broadly.
Absolutely, yes. That's exactly what I hope to do, because I've talked to Italian friends who are just suddenly talking about their grandparents, the hard work that they went through, and that was the same thing. Yeah.
So what strikes me about that, Lydia, is this intersection that we've also seen throughout the pandemic, and I want to kind of craft this intersection in my question to you. We saw frontline workers disproportionately impacted by the pandemic. We saw increases in anti-Asian American hate. We saw, we just had a conversation here on the air about health vulnerabilities of people who were low income, people who were of color. This is an intense moment of intersection among those factors. How are you thinking about that? How are you working on that? And how does art capture that in a way that moves beyond the world of art? Do you understand my question?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you're right. I think all of those factors are coming together in this moment, as well as the deep economic impact of the pandemic, which started, of course, in Chinatown earlier than in any other community, because as soon as people got word of COVID happening in China, they stopped coming to Chinatown. So I think that the idea, we're working actually with several other community groups in Chinatown and the city, and approaching the city and saying, you know what, we want a cultural plan for Chinatown. Because in this moment, this is a moment where we really need to work for recovery in so many different ways. And but a recovery which retains the community and helps to anchor us. One of our ideas is that through culture, through really helping people broadly understand the importance of Chinatown and understand the significance of anchoring that immigrant working class history and celebrating it, that we can kind of revive and enliven Chinatown's future. Because the businesses are struggling, and there's a struggle to bring people back, you know, to go to the businesses. But we want a different kind of, we don't just want the old-fashioned tourism. We want a different kind of experience where people can come to Chinatown from outside, or people within the community as well can really learn about that history and really understand what's the significance of Chinatown today.
And Wen Ti, as an artist with a long career of public art, of that intersection between art and social awareness, where does this fit? Is this sort of the last thing you wanted to do, just a thing you want to do? Where does this fit in the arc of your art?
Yes, I think art is a little bit different to social events. It's a much longer term. So these statues, I hope, will present a kind of like addressing some sort of racism that's inherent in the society. So when you talk about anti-Asian atrocities now, it's actually happened many years and many, almost like two centuries before that. And beyond that, there's the racism against Native Americans and black, slavery and everything. So I hope that public art will get people to understand both the people in the community itself, as well as people from the outside visitors, to understand better understanding of the humanity of the people, which art can provide rather than documentary and things like that. Better, I think.
And that is Wen Ti Tsen, a local artist with an ambitious new project for Boston's Chinatown, and Lydia Low, executive director of the Chinatown Community Land Trust. Wen Ti, thank you.
Thank you, Ruth.
Lydia, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination.
Gene Wilder, 1971, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. There is something that can be just magical about chocolate. It signals delicious, comforting, special. Noor Killick has been creating special chocolate concoctions in the Viennese tradition at her shop, Serenade Chocolatier in Brookline, for more than 30 years. And when we heard she was hanging up her apron, we thought, well, let's talk about what it means to have made a life in chocolate. Noor, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. Do you know your earliest memory of chocolate?
Oh, most definitely. My life was filled with chocolate. I have a dad who is a huge chocolate eater. My father and I would share giant bars of Toblerone, and we could eat the whole thing in one sitting. My mother loved making chocolate fondue, and it was not only for dipping in, but you just take a spoon and eat the whole pot.
Oh, my God, that sounds so good. The spoon into the chocolate fondue. Yeah, you got me there. That sounds amazing. Okay, so you start with this love of chocolate. Chocolate is embedded in your childhood, but you don't go into chocolate at first. You go into engineering. So how do we go from engineering to a life of making chocolate?
So at a very young age, I had this passion for not only chocolate, but cooking, baking. And for my 12th birthday, I asked my mother if I could go to this culinary class that was being offered in a community when we were living in Germany. And she said, all right, we'll try it. But, you know, if you don't finish it, I suppose I have to finish this class. So it started there, and I would make birthday cakes and chocolates for all our neighbors and anybody who would take one of my cakes at that age. And but I come from a family of engineers, and there was no other option for a career. My father was a mechanical engineer, and I was going to follow in the footsteps, but my calling came in my late 20s when I realized that's really not what I wanted to do. And I went to a short culinary class only on chocolates and jumped right in.
Did it feel like a gutsy move at the time? Did you feel like you were taking some big leap. I mean, you're in your late 20s. You're making a complete 180. You're launching a business.
It did. It did only financially, but emotionally, it was the right thing to do. And I very quickly met a mentor who just took me the rest of the way. And I knew it was the right thing to do. And you can't be working on turbines and decide to make chocolate and then go back to turbines.
So let's talk about this mentor. That you credit this mentor, Uncle Bill, William
yes.
Federer, as being your mentor, teaching you how to make chocolates in this Viennese style.
He came from a line of candy makers himself. His mother was a Viennese a chocolate maker in Vienna, and came as an immigrant during World War II. He's a World War II survivor, a Dachau survivor, and he had retired just 2 years before I opened up. And I sought his advice because I was having problems with my recipes when I first opened up.
What kinds of problems?
The most famous one is his most famous piece of chocolate, which is called a Viennese truffle. And it's layers of chocolate blended with hazelnut butter, with milk chocolate, then dark chocolate. And the layers were not sticking together. So he came in and showed me the proper way of making them and said, you know that course you went to for 6 weeks about chocolate making? You should go get a refund.
Oh, no. So then he helped you develop your concoctions.
Yes, everything, really.
What goes into choosing what you're going to make in a shop?
Oh, for me, I'm a purist. No flavorings, just if I'm working with raspberries, it has to be raspberries and passion fruit. And the dark chocolate we use is pure dark chocolate. It's just cocoa and sugar and butter and no dairy in it. So you really taste the cocoa itself. So it's really a matter of taste and keeping the ingredients pure.
All right. So you brought, the smell has just been amazing. You can smell good chocolate. So you brought some little pieces for us to try. I'm going to grab one. Do you want to grab one too?
No, no. Please go ahead. So those are tart cherries covered in the pure dark chocolate.
Oh, my God.
And it's all very good for you.
Amazing. So this is really just dark chocolate on a cherry.
Yes, on a tart cherry. And tart cherries are good for your health and reducing swelling, and dark chocolate is good for your heart. So enjoy.
Well, I can tell you it's good for my mental health, my social emotional well-being to be tasting this right now. All right. So 33 years of making chocolate.
Yes.
Two tracks running in my mind. One, how much amazing fun would it be to make chocolate for 33 years? But on the other hand, was it hard to do the same thing every day for 33 years?
There's a lot of creativity in chocolate, and over 33 years, it has evolved. Palates have evolved, and customers' knowledge has evolved also. People didn't know anything about chocolate 33 years ago, and now they understand that chocolate is made of different cocoa beans and what how the profile is made, and they question it, and we've come to appreciating vegan chocolate. It's always been vegan, but now people understand it's vegan. So there's so much to learn, and it's not repetitive. And every season I would have fun creating something new and a new truffle or a new flavor. So it never felt repetitive.
How did you guys get through COVID at Serenade?
unbelievable support from the community. I mean, it really brings me to tears even thinking about it. It's we had one customer that sent every person they knew a box of chocolates saying, this is your antiviral chocolate, take one every day. And they kept us in business. They really kept us going. I really can't even express my gratitude for the community in Brookline and what they do for small businesses.
Why do you think they did it?
I think it's a very big part of our community, and they're very invested in keeping independent businesses going. You can see that with what they do with the Coolidge Corner Theater and the Brookline Booksmith. So Brookline is really full of these little gems.
So why now? Why is it time to hang up the apron?
Well, I'd like to be able to do it when I can mentor somebody else like I was mentored, and for my trade to be passed on. I would really like it not to die out with me. So I'm able to do that before I start licking my fingers in the store. So
so tell me about that mentoring. Who are you mentoring? For how long? How are you feeling like you're embodying Uncle Bill yourself now?
I can never be Uncle Bill. But yes, she is a young woman. She's originally from Scotland, and she brings her own creativity and enthusiasm. And it's nice to have some new blood and new ideas. I had started making a bourbon truffle, and she took it to the next level, being from Scotland. So it's, I'm really enjoying it, and I'll see her through the seasons, and she's pretty much ready to launch on her own.
And so you feel like you're ready to hand the business over to the next generation.
Definitely, but I will never stop making chocolate. I've been making chocolate at home just for fun and for friends, and it's something I love. I think if you love what you do, you can never stop it.
All right, so what are your top couple of tips for people who want to be making chocolate at home? What are a couple of the basics that you can Uncle Bill all of us for the next minute or so?
So I would say, first, you have to choose your chocolate. Chocolate is very much like wine. Pick if you like your chocolate bitter or if you like it a little floral. You can go out and do a tasting of different chocolates and use that for a base. And if you'd like to dip chocolates, you can find all sorts of wonderful fruits and nuts that you can dip into chocolate. Or you can start creating ganache, which is probably the easier thing to do at home.
What's in ganache?
So ganache is a cream. It's a heavy cream blended with chocolate, and you can put liquors in it for flavor, or you can put fruits in it and cut them or shape them in any form you want and dip them at home.
Okay, that sounds amazing, but also not vegan. It doesn't sound like ganache vegan.
No, it's not vegan.
But you chocolate itself.
You can make it vegan with a coconut cream.
All right. And the candy you'll make home the most now that you're stepping away from the store?
So at home, instead of making individual pieces, because at the store we make individual little pieces that fit into boxes as gifts, I'm making bars. So I've been making pistachio bars. It's one of my favorite pieces because I use Turkish pistachios and make a bar from it, mm-hmm. Peanut butter bars and caramel bars. Mm.
I think I should visit your house. All right. Noor Killick is the founder of Serenade Chocolatier in Brookline. Noor is hanging up the apron after 33 years. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you for having me. This was my pleasure.
And it's delicious. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.